Lights are light.
Are you ready? Mm-hmm. Randy, are you ready?
Yes.
Carrie, are you ready? We are ready to tee it up. Well, good afternoon. This is an informal hearing on case number PU-09-244 and case number PU-09-245, both wind decommissioning plans, including cost and financial assurances. It is 1:33 p.m. on Wednesday, June 12th. I'm Commissioner Brian Crosius, joined by Commissioner Julie Fedorchak and Commissioner Randy Chrisman. I don't have any opening comments. Commissioner Fedorchak?
I do not either.
Commissioner Chrisman, I'll just turn it over to you. But before I do, if we could just go around the table and if staff and then the two company representatives could identify themselves.
Adam Renfant, I'm staff.
Carrie Stephenson on behalf of Otter Tail Power.
Harvey McMahon with Otter Tail Power.
All right, Commissioner Chrisman, I believe this is your portfolio. It is all yours.
Yep. Here's what we got. We have these two cases, and I'm kind of scrambling here because I had a different plan of attack and equipment didn't work. So, but I've been through the applications, and I don't know if Adam has anything to add or if we're just ready to turn it over and have Carrie or I assume it's going to be you walk through.
Sure. If it, with the commission's permission, we have a very brief outline that would give some background to these wind farms and our decommissioning plan. And I should note, we do have on the phone with us today Sean Callahan. He's the vice president of Demco, Inc., and Walter Leinick, who's the director of projects for Demco. And then Jay Kleben, who's a North Dakota licensed engineer with AE2S. And these are the firms that we used in our decommissioning study. And they'll be available for questions as well. And the handout, if it would work, what I would propose doing is just Harvey can walk through most of the handout and just do the two wind farms together because I suspect the questions are very interrelated, kind of the same questions on cost and methodology. Just by way of brief background, and Harvey will touch on this, these two wind farms at Langdon and Ashtabula, they are Otter Tail owned wind farms, are turbines, but they're part of larger wind energy centers, and NextEra would be our siblings there. So they're essentially same location as the NextEra wind farms at both the Langdon Wind Energy Center and Ashtabula 1. And the methodology, the firm that we used, Demco, is the same outfit that NextEra used, and there was an informal hearing on their decommissioning plans. I want to say that hearing was in March of 2018 with the commission having some questions and then ultimately approving those plans. So you'll see a lot of similarities to the NextEra filings and our filings and same engineering outfit. So I'd have Harvey just walk through some of the facts about these wind farms.
Yeah, so if we look at the PowerPoint here, you look at the Langdon Wind Farm. It's in Cavalier County. I know in the last meeting you guys were asking for latitude and longitudinal location of these, so we've added those. The collection roads, what we've done here is we've got 7.2 miles of road. NextEra has about 28.2 miles of road in Langdon. And if you look at proportionally the number of turbines that we have compared to the number of turbines they have, you're within 5% of the distance of roads. So the amount of collection system roads you have is similar to the number of turbines you have in a proportional basis. And then the next is how many turbines that Otter Tail owns. NextEra owns 79 turbines in Langdon 1, and all of them are the 1.5 megawatt GE SLE turbines. in-service date in 2007. And then NextEra performs the operation and maintenance for both their turbines and our turbines.
Can you hold on just one second?
Hold on just for one second. For those on the phone, we're picking up some static. I don't think it's on our end. So if you could mute your phone until you weigh in, if you do, that would be appreciated. All right, perfect. Thank you.
This is Walt, and we've been muted, so I'm not here.
I have no idea.
I didn't understand that.
Understand what?
This is Walt Lyon.
Walter Lyon.
Guy said muted.
We have been muted. This is your information.
Okay.
Thank you.
The second page here, what I wanted to kind of demonstrate was where our turbines are versus NextEra's turbines. And ours are in the black box. And if you look at just up here, the O&M building sits right there. Well, and the O&M building and the transmission line service all of Otter Tail turbines as well as NextEra turbines. So it is truly a single wind site with dual ownership.
But you break down the actual, these are ours, these are theirs.
Yes. We have two feeders which house all of our turbines, and all the rest of the feeders in that substation are on their turbines. Hmm. And then they, in Langdon, they own the substation, but we have capacity rights into that substation.
Maybe you said this earlier, but are you buying that power?
No, we own it.
The customer from the NextEra stuff?
No, NextEra's customer, I believe, is we have actually up in Langdon, we have 19 megawatts where we are the customer that they own. The rest of the customer that they have is with Minn Kota.
I see.
And then the 40 megawatts that we own, you know, we sell that into the MISO market. The next slide here is the Ashtabula. It gives you the same information about Ashtabula as we did for Langdon. You got the road mileage, the location of it. This is located east and north of Valley City. That's where Ashtabula is. And we got 48 megawatts. This was in service in December of 2008, 1 year after Langdon. And then if you flip over to the next page, you'll see the area in black. That's our those are our turbines. NextEra is to the north of us and to the south of us. So we're actually right in the heart of the Ashtabula site.
I guess I did not realize the split ownership of these farms like that.
They were...
For a different day, how that all happened, but...
They were developed together, and so then Otter Tail bought development assets from NextEra, and then we put turbines in. But they were developed at the same time using the same contractors and all that. Which kind of brings us to the decommissioning rationale. And, you know, in order to benefit customers, we're using a lot of the same contractors. DEMCO and AE2S were already in site, and they'd already done all the work to do the decommissioning plans, and so we piggybacked on that work to have our decommissioning plans done as well, rather than bringing in new contractors. So with that, you know, we've got DEMCO and we have AE2S. I haven't heard Jay yet. But we definitely have, Jay is with AE2S.
Yeah, Jay Clement is on the phone.
So we have AE2S and we have DEMCO to talk about methodologies and how they came up with their plans if those questions come up.
Right as neat as possible.
Well, I just will say this, you know, especially in the utility industry when we're down into, you know, almost minutia type decimal areas on figuring out your rates and your costs and everything else, And then when we come up with the cost estimates for these, it's $125,000 per turbine. It seems like it was a very kind of cavalier estimate. I was expecting, and I think in some of the others, maybe we've gotten more precise, or maybe there hasn't been enough of these to know more precise. And I'm not saying that this seems high or low necessarily, but was much thought given to these, or was it just sort of something that was ballparked out there?
Well, Commissioner Christman, I would let the DEMCO rep speak to the methodology. I will say that this is the same methodology that's been presented to the commission before with NextEra. I think there were about 14 wind farms at that time, and they did speak to it. That I know they are considered kind of the leaders in the demolition process. It's what they do. So they could certainly give an overview of how they came up with this, if that would help.
I guess I'm just curious to what degree of error here. If as time goes on, and maybe they've done a few more of them, if it looked like it was $135,000, would they estimate this different, or would that still round to $125,000? Or I don't know what the rounding factor is. Just would be curious. I don't need the whole detailed model.
This is Sean Client with DEMCO. We've done some more at that point, and we're still very comfortable. 125 is a conservative number. So if somebody, I think I said this on the phone last time, but if somebody gave me these jobs at $125,000 a turbine, I would do nothing but that and retire shortly after I was done, if that makes sense. So I think they're comfortable, conservative numbers. There's profit on it that you would go to bid, and people would do this work. So I don't think there's a significant margin of error. I think that it's conservative, if anything.
Does this come in the form of a written bid from whoever is going to do the work, and that bid is good for a period of X number of years?
Well, what we presented is similar to what would have been presented in the NextEra matter, and it's a cost estimate and analysis,
right?
Cost study. And I don't think it's been reduced to a binding contract, certainly, and it's not put out as a bid yet. It's an estimate that we've solicited from this firm.
Which is what we
designed the rules to be. It's just an estimate, yeah.
Not from an engineering.
Yeah.
I know what the rules are. I was just wondering if you lock them in from a business standpoint.
No, not. We have not.
I believe in the document, it does say that these are in 2017 dollars.
Okay. Could I ask a question?
Sure. Where did it envision that you would haul the stuff to when it's done? The tower and the blades and the oil in it and all of that stuff, where would that disposal be at?
Sean or Walter, did you, Jerry Lean was asking a question. Did you catch that?
Was it disposal? He's asking for disposals? Is that what he's asking for? I heard it was kind of quiet, but was it a disposal question?
Yeah, where would you haul it to?
We would take, so the C&D goes, the blades, the fiberglass blades would go to a C&D landfill, local landfill. I don't know, I have that information offhand. Oils would go to a local recycler, be tested. Everything would be sampled and tested and then offer recycling or disposal. It's all new oil, so it would be reused for recycling. The scrap metal would go to a local scrap yard and be recycled. And then that's really it for materials.
Thank you.
Well, concrete from the bases would also be recycled or reused, crushed and reused.
So do those for the scrap yards, do they actually have the capacity necessary to take that amount of recycling material?
Yes. Yeah, we would select one that did. We wouldn't select one that was a
like a small outfit. We're national contractors, so we have scrap, you know, contacts across the country. But we would, you know, we'll utilize one that has more than enough capacity for this.
And one, and those exist in North Dakota that aren't too many miles away?
Correct. Sometimes we haul. It depends on pricing. And you know, sometimes in states like that, in Colorado, I know we ship probably 50 miles, 100 miles before just to find the best recycler, best outfit that can handle the capacity that we need. But it just depends on pricing at the exact time, you know, because the scrap market changes. But it's based on pricing for us.
Okay. Do you anticipate any long-term issues with disposal of the fiberglass?
No.
So how do you do you just cut these in pieces, and kind of, if so, you know, roughly how do you do that?
Yeah, so once you know, there's a couple different ways to get them on the ground. You can either pick them down with a crane, or you can actually tip them over and pull them over. We've done them both ways. But once they're on the ground, yeah, the fiberglass blades, you just use a big chop saw or a machine, like with a shear on it. You just chop those up into manageable pieces, put those into dumpsters or live load them into trucks for disposal. And then you have the rotor and the, you know, all the components up tower are usually cast and very heavy, so you have to use, you know, burning bars or, you know, cutting torches and lances to cut those up into pieces. Manageable, that you can pick them up with an excavator, put them into a truck, or put them into a dumpster for shipment off-site. And then with the tower, again, you use a cutting torch, and you cut those into small pieces enough to manage them with the excavator, put them into dumpsters or trucks, and get them off-site. Concrete gets broken up with a hammer and loaded into dump trucks.
Do you have an estimate on how many trips it would take for, let's say, one of the, like, Langdon, like how many trips would you would it take to recycle per turbine
of which material? Just total material, just to get it off site.
Just the amount that can be recycled.
Recycled.
Yeah, they're recycled. Not the excluding the blades. And access roads.
Depending on sizing of trucks, you know, and availability of trucks, which is a significant factor in that question, because, you know, it could be 60-yard trucks or 80-yard trucks or, you know, regular dump trucks, depending on the availability at the time. But I would say between 10 and 20 loads. It's just a rough, I mean, I'd have to look at a worksheet or something like that just to see exactly. And again, it's a kind of a loaded question with sizing of trucks varying so much.
Okay, and do you have a rough estimate on how much each trip would cost?
For just the recyclables? I guess I'm a little confused. Just help me out with the question. Are we talking only for scrap?
Correct. Oh, yeah, only for the scrap.
So the scrap shipping and hauling is based in our credit for salvage, you know, for us. So that's worked in. So, you know, the scrap yard or wherever the scrap provider is would send trucks. And, you know, if it's a short haul, they won't charge us. And if it's a longer haul, it gets worked out of the price. But they would pay us for that material. So that's why that's a credit item. So if you were trying to say we were, you know, that's how that pricing's worked in. But if I had to price it out, are you looking to see if I had to price it out to just say if I was going to dispose of that material or something?
Yeah. So you're saying that in this estimate, you're offsetting that hauling estimate with the salvage value, right? So the salvage yard is giving you a discounted rate for that. Is that a fair understanding?
Correct.
Would you have an estimate that if you had to do it yourself, and what that estimate might be, such that you would exclude salvage value on that?
I, I'd have to work it up, but I could do that. It's not, you know, it's not generally what we do, but we could put that together.
Yeah, because I think these estimates, we wanted them to exclude salvage value. So I think we might be comparing apples and oranges, especially with other estimates.
Okay. Yeah, we could do that.
Yeah,
as long as Otter Tail, you know, directs us to do that, that's something we could do.
Yeah, we would be happy to refile with those numbers or provide a IR response or a late filed exhibit, whatever. I'm sorry. We would be happy to provide anything after the hearing. And I was talking with Adam beforehand. You know, we had been studying the other decommissioning studies that had been filed because I had talked with Pat during the week. And I think this goes to one of the questions that Adam and Pat had. We were able to flag some differences between us and, say, Wanzek and how they, or Demco and Wanzek. And that was one of the differences, as I understand it, that when Demco is getting quotes on transportation, it's kind of baked into the quote that they're taking something of value. So as you said, when it's close, there's no charge. And so what I think Wanzek and others have done is they've separated that out. And I think that would bring some consistency then between us and maybe some of the others. And we're certainly happy to do that.
Just to clarify one thing, though, your 125 estimate doesn't include salvage value, correct? Or does it?
Not scrap salvage value.
Not scrap.
Correct.
It's deducted off of that.
It is?
Because we don't.
Correct.
We don't consider it.
Okay, well, we can certainly clarify that.
Even though there certainly could be some value, we don't take
correct
into account.
Yeah, so if we, like, just to clarify, what ours entails is $125,000 already includes a deduction for scrap and basically a deduction for not having to haul that material because of the scrapyard. We're doing that with the scrapyard, you know. So if we were to, you know, remove the salvage credit and add the hauling and offloading of material as not as a scrap asset, it would raise our per turbine price.
Yeah, I think you'll have to, or not you, but the
we'll
company
separate
will have,
it out.
To, have to approach it that way.
And I think if we did that, then you'll see those numbers between us and Wanzek line up pretty close.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I've got that right, correct? That we don't
not consider salvage value.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
The rules changed, I believe, in 2017.
Is that the year? They
yeah,
changed
probably.
When we
yeah.
Yep.
Updated these, whichever year that was. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Can you speak a little bit more maybe about the access roads and kind of the cost of, you know, tearing up these roads and then, you know, reclaiming it?
Yeah, I think I spoke about this last time briefly, but, you know, in our experience, and I think it was in your guys' updated rules that I just saw that usually the landowner, you know, is a farmer or something of that nature, and they prefer to have the access roads back down there, and or at least access to the material. So, but what we do here is the topsoil is usually just piled up when they built these roads. They moved the topsoil off to the side. It's kind of bermed up on the side there, and they put the stone in place. So we'd be able to pull the stone out and then bring the topsoil back in from that was on the side and level it back out to the existing grade and match it, you know. So it's not a very complicated process. If you have the right equipment, it's just a matter of having the right, you know, excavators or bulldozers or whatever equipment you want to put in place there at the time and working the dirt or the stone that way.
So I'll say on this note, somewhere in here in your decommissioning plan, it addresses this and that it would hinge on a landowner request. Do you call it that is?
Mm-hmm.
The exception being a request signed by the applicable landowner requesting the road features remain in place.
Okay, so that is not what the rules really say, because, you know, most reclamation things, if you pay people enough, they'll be glad to leave them. You know, I'm guessing a lot of these turbines, if you paid someone $100,000 to just leave it out there, they'd probably take that. But that's not what we want for the future of the state. And so the rules were created, the goal was to potentially leave the option of leaving roads that are going to be used and useful for that landowner, but not to create an incentive for the company to go out and pay that landowner a little bit less than what it costs to reclaim it, to just get them to accept it. And so, and this isn't an exact quote, but it's very close, what the rule says, unless the commission approves an owner request signed by the applicable landowner identifying surface features and the reason. And so wherever that was in here, and I couldn't get this in time to mark it up, and I knew this would happen, and I can't quite find it now, but I thought I'd seen it twice in each of them.
I believe our quote does state that it does, we are removing the roads to their full extent, though, correct?
That's how the quotes seem to be done, but just the terminology. I don't want to get down the road and have the company coming back and saying, well, for years we filed this, and it just said if the landowner wants it, we can leave it, and we got them to want it. It's something that also takes the commission approval.
Thank you, Commissioner Christman. That's something we can certainly clarify in an amended filing, I think it's implicit in our filings that anything that's required approved by the commission, we're going to seek it. So, but we'll be very clear about that.
I'd appreciate that, because I don't want to get, we used to leave it up to them, and that's how we ended up with abandoned mine lands.
And so right now, these your composite blades are being sent to a landfill, right? You're not aware of any ability to recycle those, are you?
We haven't found any so far. It's always nice, you know, we've chased some options before, you know, since it's just kind of purely a fiberglass and this and that, but it's been difficult to find a home for them. So we have, unfortunately, had to put those in the landfill, but that's one of the only things that goes to a landfill on the entire project. So, but we always keep our options open, try to find, you know, a recycler or somebody that could do something with it, but it's just that's just the way it's been.
Okay. Just a curiosity question. So when you're talking about recycling, can you recycle fiberglass, or is fiberglass just to bury it?
Yeah,
Well, you or the individual from Demco.
We have not had success recycling fiberglass.
All right. Okay, so it doesn't exist as we...
There may be some alternative use for it somewhere, but I have not found it, and I'm going to continue to look, but we've had to put them into a landfill.
And I don't know if this is the appropriate time, but I could address the financial assurance component if you'd like. It applies to both decommissioning plans. We looked at the rule, and it allows various forms of financial assurance. And the two that am I causing that? It seems
like
it's me.
Well, if you quit repeating yourself, then it wouldn't happen.
They haven't to date them.
I'm going to step back just a little bit. Something on the other end. I
quote back to the subline. Yeah, I think so.
The rule allows various forms of financial assurance, and the most relevant is the self-guarantee, which I think was part of the new rules that is permissible for regulated utilities, of course, which we are one. And there's also the catch-all that you see a lot in commission rules. assurance that it's acceptable to the commission to cover anticipated costs, or another form of financial insurance that is acceptable to the commission to cover anticipated costs of decommissioning. And initially, we were simply going to file a self-guarantee with the commission, and we noticed a few issues with that. And the first is we just couldn't get our hands on a really good example of that being done in North Dakota or in other contexts. And we did find, and I've talked to Jack about this, and I know I own some templates that I've tracked down. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has a form that's published in the Federal Register for nuke decommissioning, but it's very cumbersome, as you might expect, very elaborate. We didn't think we'd want to distill that or put that burden on you to read it. And we also, in talking with our finance folks...
Hi. Whoever's typing in the background, if you could mute your phone again, that would be great.
And we also, our finance folks, we had a conversation with them that some of the power companies' debt instruments have covenants that we could get the self-guarantee, but there would be some hoops to jump through with pre-authorizations, and we'd have to go back, and it was a bit cumbersome to do it that way as well. And then when we looked at the self-guarantee, we thought, we're really not giving you much more than what you already have. I mean, we're a regulated utility. We are obligated by law to follow through on our commitments. So then we asked, have we done this anywhere else? Have we done it for anybody else? Is there some kind of methodology we could provide you that not only said we're good for it, a promise is a promise, but also would give something in the record that shows we are actually good for it financially, that we have the strength to follow through on these. So what we did, talking internally, we give financial assurances to the State Department of Health for our ash disposal obligations at Coyote Station. We do that every year. And there's a financial test, actually, in the North Dakota Administrative Code under the Department of Health rules that we have our CFO certify. Here's line one, line two, line three. So we thought, well, this might be something that the commission would find useful. It is a financial test. It is something that demonstrates our financial strength. It lists our most recent bond ratings from Moody, S&P, and Fitch, and it gives our net tangible asset worth, and that's in our filing. And what it demonstrates, again, it's our bond ratings, and that's certified by Deloitte, our independent auditors, and there's a certification letter attached to it. And it lists our tangible net worth of $550 billion, and it then has a ratio of that related to, is our tangible net worth at least four times the costs of our obligations? Well, of course, we're well within that range. And we thought, why don't we use that, which is already part of the North Dakota Administrative Code, provide that with a certification from our CEO that it's correct and that we will abide by our decommissioning obligations. And I know that doesn't fit exactly into a self-guarantee, but there is the general language of any form the commission will find satisfactory. And if it's not, we will certainly go back and produce a self-guarantee, but we thought this would be at least worth presenting to the commission as something that might be useful.
I mean, I will admit I'm not a finance guy, but here's my concern. Yes, you're a regulated utility, so is PG&E in California. When things go bad, though, anything can fall apart. And so you get your bond rating, and when we created these rules one time, I remember having discussions with people who are better at finance than I, and trying to compare to what we do with some, not self, but corporate guarantees with mining. And, of course, there's more of a track record and life lessons there since we've been doing that for 40 years. And when one of the outside companies is guaranteeing some of these mine reclamation costs, that is somehow showing up on their books. The the bond rating company is aware of that. It shows up as some type of a liability or something like that. And so what you're talking about, if it shows up that investors and bond rating companies are aware that these guarantees are real obligations that the company has taken on, then I think I would feel comfortable with it. But if it's just something that, unless someone knows to sit and research our stuff or is sitting in this room, would even be aware that you took it on as an obligation, then how do we know what other obligations the company's all taken on? And so the bonding company could continue to have very high ratings because they're not aware. And so however it works, it just needs to be something that is a part of the company's books to me and is in fact an obligation that is recognized by people who evaluate those things. Does that make sense?
I think so, Commissioner Christman, if I'm tracking. And I guess as I'm thinking out loud, a self-guarantee might have more visibility like that. In the end, it's just a statement from Otter Tail that we will, very similar to what we provided, that we will honor these commitments and we have the financial wherewithal to do it. I think our attempt here was to supplement that with some demonstration that we do have the financial wherewithal. Otherwise, it's just a statement. It may give you some additional rights that I'm not aware of in a circumstance. But again, our effort here, we thought it would be useful to provide the information that shows we are certainly capable of taking care of these obligations.
But with what you're proposing, I mean, we would only accept these from companies with good bond ratings.
Commissioner Christman, well, not necessarily. The rules allow you to whatever you're satisfied with, and you certainly if you were to evaluate other companies and they had horrible ratings, you might become nervous, but I'm not sure where you would feel comfortable drawing that line. I just know ours is on the safe side of that line.
I'd like to see what you're thinking, and if I'm interpreting it correctly, it just strengthens the argument.
That was our intent.
The self-guarantee has teeth behind it.
And we can certainly go back and provide a self-guarantee, and I can work with Jack. I know I've had conversations with him on what those should look like. Because some commissions, I think, have adopted guarantee formats that are acceptable, say, for parent guarantees. What the rules permit for regulated utilities, they can provide a self-guarantee, and I assume the rationale for that rule was the regulated utilities are not going anywhere. A little different risk, say, than a developer that's from out of state, and you don't have any jurisdiction over those developers. So we can certainly come back with a proposed self-guarantee, and if that would be a more formal statement in the commission's view, I certainly appreciate and understand that.
I'm not saying you need to. I just need to learn more about this and think about it more. So it's certainly not saying I would object to this as you're proposing, but
thank you.
I guess I got to study it more.
So self-guarantee.
No, there's no definition in the rules as to what constitutes that. And I've seen different examples. Again, the most thorough example, if I will, was the NERC standards. But again, that would be cruel and unusual punishment on staff to file that.
Duly noted.
Humanitarian amongst us.
I'm not uncomfortable with the thing from the health department, but I'm open to what you guys want to propose. If there's something else.
Well, if the commission, again, if the commission feels, I certainly understand Commissioner Christman's statement. He needs to study it and think about it a little bit. And if their conclusion is that, well, we really would want you, we want to see what a self-guarantee would look like, we will produce one. What we did here was trying to find a balance that, hey, we already do this for another agency under rules of the state that provides a financial test that puts something in the record that shows we are
very solid in terms of being able to handle this obligation, coupled with we have a letter from our CFO that's attached to it saying, you know, this is what is Otter Tail Power Company, and we will address the decommissioning obligations in our filing, and we will take care of those obligations.
Is a self-guarantee, is that additional work for you guys? Is it to somehow obligate finances that makes it a lesser option in your eyes, or why
yes.
did you go this route as opposed to it?
Well, that was one of the reasons, but again, and we started thinking, well, we have a great, we thought, a template that we already do this, and maybe we can leverage that. One of the issues is that in a self-guarantee, you get into terminology, and I haven't studied these in our you know, credit facilities, about sometimes there are restrictions on guarantees. Typically, it's simply limited to third-party guarantees. Your lenders don't want you guaranteeing the debt of another party, and they'll give you some leeway on how much you can do. After that, though, you have to get pre-approvals and so forth, but then you get into the world of accountants and finance people and, of course, lawyers on what is the scope of the guarantee. I think self-guarantee would fall outside of that, but rather than have to go through that process and in the interest of doing something we thought might even be better, we proposed using the Department of Health rules. But again, we can go back and go through that process. And I think it would fall outside the scope of your normal guarantee that you would find restricted covenants in your debt instruments. But if we could avoid that, that's less work as well. So,
well, one thing we have going for us here, this isn't like the new ones where getting all this filed is potentially holding up construction or holding up operations. We've got a little time to work, so let me work on that a little bit more.
I do think it's important to keep in mind the reason why we had that one part of our rules where we say you can self-guarantee or parent guarantee if you're an electric public utility, because we see you all the time and we have a feel for your books and your financial strength. And so I think that's part of the reason why we intended to make it a little less onerous for you to provide a self-guarantee. So I'm not interested in creating a bunch more work for you guys to do what we intended, to provide an avenue for it to be relatively easy, because we do have some leverage with you guys already. So
yes, you do, Commissioner Fukurchak. And again, that was part of our reasoning as well, that we do have regular contact. And of course, you are always monitoring our status and our performance. And so we're a little different position than, say, some of the other wind farm operators in the state.
So how do you take this? Are you going to go back and what do you want? What are we asking for here, I guess, in terms of
I could propose something to see if that would be suitable. If that
sure.
Would. What I would propose doing is doing an amended filing. And the focus, we would have DEMCO provide the numbers that Adam has questioned. To pull out those things that have a scrap value. And I think that would then bring some consistency in what I have seen in the other filings. So we would do an amended filing. As part of that filing, we would provide those new numbers. And with that, I would also make clear and address Commissioner Christman's point about landowner consent subject to the commission's approval. And if the commission desired, we can certainly prepare a self-guarantee, but my suggestion would be to limit that amended filing to those points. And if there's still some discomfort level, we'll add the self-guarantee into it.
I think you're onto a good plan. If I don't learn more that causes me to think there's a big problem with this, we'll kind of aim toward this direction.
I think you addressed the concern I had, and that is that the financial guarantee cannot include the sale of scrap metal, et cetera, even though, you know, behind the scenes or in part of your internal calculations, you may have, obviously, you're going to have estimates from a business standpoint, and even though that salvage value will often exceed hauling cost, and you'll actually make a little bit of money, or potentially could, it's, we can't consider it because that's not how the rules are written.
No, and we could, unless the commission had a different time frame, we certainly could file within 30 days, within 2 weeks. 30 days would certainly be safe to ensure that DEMCO can do the calculations and provide the supporting documentation.
That's reasonable for me.
I think it is, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sounds good.
All right.
Easy.
It's actually, it's Ballstuhl in your court. You're in charge.
Okay. This is, it probably isn't a concern as far as the reclamation, and depending on what your answer is, then maybe it will be. I'm looking at the Langdon one now, and the 2018 statistics, and it listed a capacity factor of 40.32, but it was around 47 in 17. And then Ashtabula was around 39 in 17 and down to 36 in 18. Was 18 just a poorer wind year on the eastern half of the state, or are these projects aging out to a point where their productivity is dropping significantly?
That? 18 was a poorer wind year overall, but the other issue that we had was icing. There was a lot more icing, and in 2019, January in particular, we had a ton of icing. But I would say 2018 was a combination of the icing and a poorer wind year.
Do you get curtailed more from MISO?
For Langdon, no. Ashtabula, no. Okay. If most of the curtailment is dispatchable intermittent resource curtailment where you have low LMP prices, and I mean, I haven't prepared to answer the question, but I would venture to say we're under 1%.
Thanks.
Under 1% in terms of
production.
In terms of being able to actually sell that.
What's that?
Yeah, maybe I missed.
Oh, so for instance, if our production was 100%, the DIR would be 1% of that. So 1% of your production, less than 1% of our production has been curtailed using DIR. And again, I haven't run the numbers, but I know that as I look at that from a monthly basis, it's consistently either well under 1% or next to zero.
What's DIR?
Dispatchable intermittent resource. It's the curtailment method that MISO uses. And so what it does...
Too much?
Well, what will happen is if, as they're trying to dispatch the generation around the system, your energy component of LMP is the same throughout MISO.
Right.
And then you have congestion. You also have losses, but congestion's your big one. If they don't want energy from a certain area, they'll up that congestion, which will lower the cost of your locational marginal pricing. And so we bid these into the system at, you bid them in at zero, because that's the variable cost of energy. Or if they're still with a PTC, you bid them in at negative 30-ish range, and that's your PTC. You lose that if you get curtailed.
Right.
So you're putting it in at a much lower level. Now, given how we're bidding it in, that's where less than 1% of our production is consistently being curtailed.
And why, help me understand why it would be curtailed. What drives the curtailment?
The price, your locational margin pricing at the point you put it into the MISO market. And so for instance, if you had, if you're putting it in at this point and all your load's over here, and a transmission line goes down in between, and you can't push the energy over, they want generation from this side in order to serve the load.
Oh, they made the price higher on your side so that there would be less coming across, right?
From a generator standpoint, they made the price lower to try to get you to stop.
I see.
Yeah, but if from a load side, you're trying to make it. Yes. Yeah. Yep.
Got it.
And that's what the dispatchable intermittent resource, the DIR.
So they must make it lower than the negative price that you're throwing out there.
If they want us to shut down, they have to put it lower than the negative price, yes.
And that is only happening 1% of the time?
Less than 1%, yeah.
Less than 1% of the time on an annual basis or what?
Yeah.
And then if they need to, they can just tell you to get off, right?
That's a different type of curtailment. That's a reliability curtailment. Yeah. And I can't remember one of those in...
Okay. So, I mean, at night, if the coal's running at minimum and they're going to have to shut down a coal plant, they can just curtail the wind instead.
A lot of that's going to be, they're going to do that through DIR. They're going to start lowering pricing in order to incentivize people to come offline.
Okay.
So you're pretty much selling 100% of what you use all the time. 99% of the time.
The answer to
but the wind
is
might
yes.
But the, yeah. But the wind might be blowing and you're not, the turbines aren't operating, correct?
If that's the 99%, if the wind's blowing,
they're spinning. So the whole argument for battery storage seems to be a moot point, since whatever you're producing, you're selling.
What's that?
Well, when you hear about, you know, from a reliability standpoint, you hear about battery storage is the answer, right, for the periods when the wind doesn't blow. But if you're selling it all, there's nothing to store. Or am I misunderstanding the 99% mark? I'm not arguing with you.
You could more and store it.
There's actually a lot to what you're saying, and there's just a lot of different ways to look at it. Because if you want to put in way more wind than you need, rather than selling it at negative values or shutting down,
right,
you can produce into batteries, and then when the wind's not blowing, the batteries can feed in. But I went to a seminar, ESIG, in March, and there was some interesting concepts that they were putting forth in that. And there's just a lot of ways to look at that.
Batteries would allow you to wait and sell it at times when the price is better than
correct
whenever it's
reasonable. Yep. Or you can actually take your load if you have like hydrogen fuel cells that are real high energy users, and only run those plants when your wind is blowing. And then that's your storage mechanism. Rather than using batteries, you're actually using a end product as your storage for vehicles. There was some pretty interesting concepts there. And they even talked about putting transmission lines tying in the entire world across oceans.
Oh, wow.
And that was one I was like, all right, that's an interesting one. But yeah. They had some pretty unique solutions to some problems there.
I have trouble getting along with oceans between us. Can you imagine if we're all on one grid? But anything else on that?
No.
I do have Thank one you. Thing before we wrap up on the certificate of operation. I don't know if this is your own creation or if because of the Next Era decision we made a year or so ago, if this is becoming a template. If this is becoming a template, I see one thing missing in here, though. I looked at it. I was so pleased because it's simple. And I thought, oh, but it's missing something, so let's complicate it, right? One of the rules is that if no energy is generated by one or more turbines for the time period specified in the certificate of operation, a written explanation for the non-generating wind turbines must accompany the certificate. So when you just give us the megawatt hours produced for the month, we wouldn't really notice if one or two on the side were abandoned and broken down and not getting done. The point was, if that is the case, we want those cleaned up. And so we couldn't tell that from this.
So do you want just a statement stating that there are no turbines that meet that criteria? And if there are, then...
I think at this point that's fine with me, or what was the monthly output of your lowest producing turbine? Or I don't really have a set idea in mind, but there needs to be something to indicate that nothing is... that none of them are producing nothing or right next to nothing.
Commissioner Christman, we can certainly do that, either affirmatively state there's nothing to report on that issue, or, of course, report on that issue so it's not ambiguous in the document.
Thank you. Yeah. I don't have anything else.
Okay. All right. Anything else from staff or the company? Okay. Seeing none, the handouts and material, as well as the audio recording today of this proceeding, is now considered evidence. Is there any objection to this evidence becoming a part of the official record upon which a decision will be reached?
No objection.
Jerry? Adam? No objection? Okay. And I don't believe there's anything else that anyone wants to add. Then the evidence as presented will now become part of the official record upon which a decision will be made. Are there any other matters for the record? Seeing none, this informal hearing is now closed. Thank you.